You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 13th of May 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Russia's defense minister is launched upon a likely somewhat sleepless retirement. A German court allows German intelligence services to spy on a German political party. And are the Japanese really unusually forgetful? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Olga Tokariuk and Jacob Parakilis will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll hear from Sir Laurie Bristow, the UK's former man in Kabul, about his extraordinary book chronicling the last desperate days of the West's 20-year intervention in Afghanistan. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Olga Tokariuk, Ukrainian journalist and fellow at Chatham House Leadership Academy, and by Jacob Parakilis, research leader for RAND Europe's Defence and Security Research Group. Hello to you both.
Hello, Andrew.
Good evening.
Jacob, you're back. You went away for years, and now you're back. Tell our listeners, where have you been?
I was in civil service, American version. I was working at the U.S. Embassy in London as a political military specialist, which, in general, the State Department is not hugely in favor of its employees freelancing and doing commentary. So I was not allowed to do any kind of public-facing work.
So what can you tell us about the work you are now doing?
Well, RAND Europe is the European arm of the originally American RAND Corporation. We do a lot of different research. We have a very large defense and security research group that looks primarily after sort of European and British security issues, although there is some more global focus as well. But it's policy research frequently on contract governments.
Well, welcome back to The Daily. Olga, it has been a shorter interval since you last sat at this table, and I feel like I owe you an apology because last time you were here, regular listeners will recall, you asserted that there was a capybara in Hanwell, which is a little regarded suburb in West London. I was incredulous at this news, but I can confirm that there is one because on Saturday I went there and I saw it.
Oh, well, I'm very happy that you acknowledge I was right that time. But also, Andrew, you missed one important thing. It's not in Hanwell because it's not living in the wild. It's in Hanwell Zoo.
Well, that is true. But the zoo is in Hanwell, hence the name.
Is.
But no, there is, listeners, I promise you I'm not making this up, and nor was Olga, there is a capybara in Hanwell. Do you think there's just the one? You were saying you had heard rumours that there are two.
That's an urban legend. I'm not sure. But, when I made a decision to go there, well, I read reviews on Google, and some people said that they saw another one. So, of course, I went there thinking, well, I'm going to see the two of them, but no.
Perhaps it was a ghost. Just finally, before we move on, I do have to ask you for your views on Eurovision. I won't ask you, Jacob, because as an American, your views on Eurovision are completely uninteresting. But Ukraine...
I watch the whole thing. I watch every year.
Ukraine, of course, these last few years, Olga, has done quite well. I had on my card, I had Ukraine third this year behind Armenia and Croatia, which would have been no disgrace. But do you feel like you were robbed a bit?
No, not really. I think nobody really expected Ukraine to win this year. And the third place is a very decent place. Mm. Ukraine is consistently delivering at Eurovision. You know, Ukraine is... in the last years, regularly sending very good performers, staging really good shows, and that's a reason to be proud of.
Well, we will return to Ukraine shortly, but we will start in Russia with the news that Sergei Shoigu has been removed as defense minister after 12 years of service. He is to be exiled to a decorative-seeming new role as secretary of Russia's Security Council, which will at least enable him to continue drawing a salary until his tragic death in a lawn-mowing accident next Thursday. While Shoigu is apparently being lumbered with the blame for the fact that Russia's 72-hour lightning conquest of Ukraine is now at day 811, his replacement has been announced as Andrei Belousov, a little heralded bean counter lately serving as Deputy Prime Minister. Olga, first of all, how is this going to be seen from Ukraine, or do Ukrainians not really care one way or the other who Russia's defense minister is at a given moment?
Yeah, I think they don't really care, and they see it rather, you know, as like a struggle and a battle of spiders in a jar. What Russians are doing in all these replacements, it's basically just pretending that they have some accountability at the government level, you know, that the ministers can be replaced, there can be some accountability, while it's all a theater, it's all a performance. And Russia is not performing that well in Ukraine, although it started a new offensive in recent days, and we'll talk about that later. So I think Ukrainians do not really see that it will bring any change in Russia's very well manifested and reiterated intentions to just destroy Ukraine.
Jacob, it's not necessarily surprising that Putin is reshuffling his cabinet. He has, of course, just renewed his mandate as president, and that is the sort of thing that people who've just been re-elected do, even if they've been re-elected in a proper election. But what do you read from this? Do you think that Shoigu is being kind of scapegoated here, or perhaps scapegoated in advance?
I don't know if I want to make a judgment on that yet. I mean, certainly one of Shoigu's deputies has been arrested and charged with corruption. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of reason to believe that there is significant corruption all up and down the ranks. And we've seen in all sorts of authoritarian contexts, the sort of anti-corruption drive being used as a, you know, sort of nominally anti-corruption, and there may be actual corruption, usually in places where there is corruption. Sort
but
of
it's mostly a means of whacking one's enemies.
It's mostly a means of centralizing power. So there may very well be something like that. I think there's a bigger thing here, especially with the appointment of essentially an economist as Minister of Defense, is that Putin is trying to reorganize the economy. He's trying to push Russia towards a long-term war economy under the assumption that eventually the West will get bored and tired and, you know, its support for Ukraine will start to diminish, and that Russia, because of its greater mass, because of its ability to absorb untold amounts of punishment, will win through sort of having a sustainable long-term war economy. That the battlefield performance, which, as Olga notes, as you note, has not been particularly good, is less important than reorganizing Russia to be able to continue generating force, even if it's 19-year-old conscripts driving 70-year-old tanks. That if that keeps sort of pumping forward, eventually you can win through sheer willpower. I think that's the message here.
I mean, Olga, that has been the fairly unadorned official line from the Kremlin, that this is Russia reorienting its economy to be on a more or less permanent war footing, and that's why they're putting a civilian economist in charge of the Ministry of Defense. But does this strike you as yet another indication to the West beyond Ukraine? I'm sure Ukraine doesn't need telling what it's up against, that Russia is serious about this, and therefore that the West has to be serious about this as well.
Well, yes, absolutely. Russia is very much serious about destroying Ukraine as a sovereign and independent state, not as some sort of marionette of Russia. That's the only Ukraine that Russia is willing to see and that it would agree to, having some puppet regime in Kyiv and completely managed state. And of course, I think that's another confirmation that Russia is preparing for a long game, for a long war, potentially not only against Ukraine. You know, if you watch Russian state propaganda TV, you'll hear over and over again they are constantly saying that they are at war with the entire West, not just with Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think the West should finally acknowledge that they are already at war with Russia, even though it's Ukrainians who are fighting at the moment.
Just finally on this, a little bit further Kremlinology? I can't pronounce Kremlinology, and it's only Monday. Got it the third time. Before we move on, Sergei Shoigu, the job he has been given, had been hitherto held by Nikolai Patrushev, Putin's old KGB buddy and widely believed to be one of his guiding ideologues. Details of his next appointment are, it says here, still to be announced. But do we make anything from that? Could there be an amount of Putin trying to clean house here?
I I don't know is the short answer. I mean, I think it's always dangerous when you have a...
Would you care to speculate wildly?
I will speculate responsibly. When you have an inner circle that is beholden to you personally, the danger of moving someone out of a coveted position, a powerful position, is that you take that loyalty and you turn it into... a feeling of betrayal. Mm. And as we've seen, you know, that happened with Prigozhin, you have this ability, you know, this potential for that betrayal to metastasize very, very quickly. So I think one of the many, many problems with a kind of personalist authoritarian system is that you end up having to manage not only the sort of competing power structures, but the competing psychologies and personalities of people who are used to bending the world to their whim and accepting no limits, moral or otherwise, on their behavior. And that's a dangerous position to be in.
Well, in Ukraine, meanwhile, Russia claims small advances in the vicinity of Kharkiv, Ukraine's second biggest city. What is certain is that thousands of Ukrainian people have been evacuated from the area. Russia made a significant incursion over the weekend near the Ukrainian border town of Vovchansk, 74 kilometers from Kharkiv, prompting fear and or speculation that Russia could be contemplating a renewed attempt to take Kharkiv itself. Speaking over the weekend, Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said that Ukrainian forces were counterattacking. Olga, you alluded to this incursion earlier. Do we know how serious it seems?
It is quite serious, and even the Ukrainian government was forced to acknowledge that the situation is quite serious and that there are really heavy battles going on in Kharkiv region. Russians are attacking from several directions, mostly in the north from Russian territory itself, but also from the occupied territories of Ukraine that are bordering Kharkiv region. And according to some estimates, Russians managed to capture, these are official. This is actually official data, some official data and some data by Ukrainian military experts, that Russian captured 11 small villages in Kharkiv mm-hmm. region since Friday when this new offensive began. And I've even seen the number of 100 square kilometers, which is quite impressive considering that from the start of this year, 2024, and before this new offensive in Kharkiv regions, Russian captured around 300 square kilometers in Ukraine. And, you know, it's one third of what they've managed to capture in the first 5 months of this year, and only over the weekend, only over the last 3 days, they managed to capture, you know, such a quite sizable amount of territory.
Jacob, if we're attempting to be optimistic about this, is it arguable that what we're watching is still the consequence of that lag in supplies and funding occasioned by the long delay caused by American domestic politics, and that now that money and those weapons are available, momentum might shift back towards the Ukrainians?
Yeah, I mean, the passage of the foreign aid supplemental isn't an immediate magic wand. I mean, the delay had real and significant consequences in terms of the availability, particularly of crucial artillery shell and air defense interceptor. And that has a number of impacts on the front. You can, if you have to very carefully husband your air defenses. It means you can only strike the highest priority targets. You can't take low probability pot shots at, for example, Russian bomber aircraft that are lobbing glide bombs with GPS guidance, which can destroy command posts, which force the Ukrainian forces to disperse, to operate less efficiently. You can't shoot down every incoming cruise missile. You have to aim for the highest danger targets, which means that, you know, some of your troops are going to, you know, be in danger of being struck. You're going to your lines will be suppressed more. The disparity in artillery fire, at one point I saw 11-1 cited as the number of Russian shells fired versus Ukrainian shells. And it's very difficult to maintain a consistent defense if you can only respond with one shot to your opponent's 11. So aid is flowing again now, and that will help, but it takes a long. There are only so many cargo aircraft. There are only so many trains. There are only so many pallets that you can actually physically ship things into the country on. So it will take a while before the stockpiles are refurbished. And especially because with this intensity of operations, things that are going into the country are going to be used almost immediately. So there will be an immediate need following the last immediate need.
I mean, Olga, it's a question I know I've asked you a few times over the last couple of years or so, but the one about Ukrainian morale, Ukrainian optimism, has there been any sign of that wavering in recent months as, one, it's become clearer than ever that this is likely than not to last for a very, very long time, and also because the situation on the battlefield has become more difficult?
Well, Russia is clearly counting on that, you know, and just to add to what Jacob just said, Russia is also trying to target those supplies of Western weapons that are flowing in Ukraine. They're launching missiles to ammunition to strike ammunition depots. So you know, one of their targets, in addition to Ukraine's energy infrastructure, which they bombed really heavily in recent weeks. And Ukrainian air defense was not able to intercept those missiles. I've seen today the figures that Germans published, which indicate that in the last 6 months, Ukrainians were only able to intercept around 30% of Russian missiles and drones, and that's half of what they were able to intercept in the 6 months before that. And that just gives you an idea of, you know, the shortage of the air defense, and that Ukraine really had to prioritize certain missiles targeting more important targets and intercept those, but not the other ones. But coming back to your question on, you know, Ukrainian kind of resolve and desire and willingness and morale, willingness to defend itself. Of course, like, people are tired, you know, the war has been going on for more than 2 years. But one thing has not changed is that it is still the war for Ukraine's survival, and everybody's conscious of that. And, you know, the losses are huge, and people are tired, but they know what's at stake, you know, and there is really no other choice. If you look at the opinion polls, there is really not a big drop in the number of those Ukrainians who are saying that they are willing and ready to fight for as long as it takes to push Russians away, and that they do not believe that any territorial concessions or any type of concessions to Russia will work, because that would just embolden Russia to attack more and to come back for more.
Jacob, for those of Ukraine's allies who either also understand what's at stake or claim to understand what's at stake, which is not just Ukraine's survival, but Europe's security, how important is a sense of momentum on the battlefield? I mean, it's that thing where, and I understand that this has been a source of conflict between occasionally President Zelensky and his military commanders. It's not just a question of actually winning on the battlefield. You actually have to be seen to be winning.
And I think the Ukrainian government gets that. The Ukrainian public information operation facing the West has been very sophisticated and very targeted. And I think, you know, the degree to which it has highlighted the contributions that Ukrainian servicemen and women equipped with Western equipment are able to make to the sovereignty and survival of their country is really, really impressive. And that means something in the West. But it's, you know, there is a sort of, there's a disconnect between the political timeline in the West and the timeline that it takes to be able to build up a military force that is able to reconquer territory that has been occupied, fortified, turned into a defensive, I mean, as we saw with the counteroffensive last summer, it's much easier to defend territory than to take it back. And taking it back requires a sort of, not just the willingness and ability of soldiers, but also this very, very complicated mixture of infantry, armored forces, air forces, air defense forces, intelligence, surveillance, logistics, all these elements working together, you know, the ability to push through and take land that's heavily fortified is something that, you know, every military in the world struggles with. And being able to construct that into an army that is at war, that has taken grievous losses, that is fighting every single day for its nation's survival is an incredibly difficult task and doesn't necessarily cohere with the sort of we want to see results in consulting inflected political mindset that I think maybe some people in the West expect.
Well, let's move along to Germany, where with just a few weeks to go before European elections, in which far-right headbanger parties are anticipated to do depressingly well, one German iteration thereof has lost a court case which might have spared it the invigilation of Germany's intelligence services. An earlier ruling has been upheld, which affirmed AfD, Alternative for Deutschland, and its youth wing as extremist organisations, which entitles Germany's spooks to monitor their activities and communications. communications. The judges said they were, quote, convinced that there are sufficient factual indications that the AFD is pursuing efforts that are directed against the human dignity of certain groups of people and against the principle of democracy. I will come back to the wider question of what happens when a country's judicial system and country's intelligence services decide that a country's legitimate political party is in fact a seditious fifth column. But Olga, I have to say my first sympathies are for whichever intelligence operatives are now actually going to have to monitor AFD's communications.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. That must be a daunting task. Well, with the AFD case, you know, this ruling is based on their activities when it comes to the issue of migration and on how they tried. Basically, they participated in some meetings in which they discussed the possibility to deport people who are of foreign origin from Germany. So that caused then massive protests, and there were protests in Germany earlier this year because of that. But what kind of attracts more of my attention in the case of AFD are the other scandals that are related to Russia. Two Indeed. Of the top candidates at the European Parliament elections from the AFD, they've been reportedly receiving money from Russia and China. Major German media like Der Spiegel reported about that. And that party has been repeating Russian propaganda narratives for years. And, you know, there have been doubts. Are they doing it for free because they are useful idiots of the Kremlin, or are they actually getting paid for it? And it's almost a relief for me to know that they are actually paid for this. They are not just useful idiots who are, you know, been doing that for free.
Is it depressingly likely, Jacob, that this will work to their electoral advantage? Because one thing they do have in common with populist movements all over Europe and indeed in the United States is that they advance this narrative that they are being persecuted by the establishment. And right here we have the establishment judiciary enjoining the establishment's intelligence services to bug their phones and read their emails.
It's an interesting one because on the one hand, yes, the sort of being targeted by the deep state is a very common theme across populist, nationalist, far-right, occasionally far-left, but sort of the counter-establishment
I'm not sure parties. If it counts as the deep state if they tell you they're doing it.
Well, that's funny, but it's actually – there is a kind of weirdly paradoxical thing about this where – a lot of the power of that is to say the state is operating in the shadows. It is coming after us through the sort of shadowy, illicit organs of the state. There is a conspiracy against us. And if the state is actually coming out and saying quite openly and vocally, we think you're a threat and we're going to surveil you because we have judged you a threat, I think that actually robs some of the power from the deep state. I mean, you know, people who are conspiratorially minded and, you know, believe in shadowy conspiracies aren't going to particularly pay attention. But those people are already kind of activated by those movements. The question is, can a party make inroads with voters who are convincible? And I think the fact that the government is doing it out in the open through a sort of established legal process maybe robs some of the power this is an illicit operation narrative.
I mean, it is nonetheless a very strange situation, Olga, because it's not like the AFD are a entirely tiny faction of fringe cranks. I mean, it would be preferable if they were, but they are actually extremely popular. They are legitimately elected to the Bundestag, to state houses all over Germany. As a general philosophical point, should the state be in the business of spying on a political party with genuinely meaningful popular support?
Well, you see, the state and the government is saying it's what the court decided. It's not what we decided by their own decree, by the government decree, but that's actually because the judges have said that, you know, this party represents a risk of extremism and is a national security threat. That's how they are framing it. And, it's quite a popular party. It used to be the second most popular party in Germany just recently. I don't know what's the ranking now, but they are also not the only one, you know. There are other far-right parties in Germany that are actually rising because the electorate of the AfD is outflowing and, you know, joining other ones, other similar parties with similar agendas. So I'm not sure that place will remain empty.
I mean, just a final thought on this, Jacob, and it, Germany is a special case for reasons we do not need to go into about being worried about far-right xenophobic political parties attracting a measure of popular support by framing a conspirazoid narrative. But are they being somewhat hypersensitive about this? Ultimately, and I realise even as I say it that we have seen any number of examples to contradict this proposition, should the people's wisdom not be trusted?
I mean, I think there are different mechanisms at the state level, and they vary enormously state by state. I think in the American context, for example, it would fall afoul of both sort of specific constitutional provisions and the way that we have framed the relationship between our judiciary and our electoral systems to specifically declare one party a threat. Mm. There would be a separate mechanism, and I'm not sure that sort of the moving everything into the realm of we are going to have an impartial judiciary and law enforcement mechanism that will investigate all things is necessarily a more effective mechanism for managing sort of anti-establishment, anti-democratic threats writ quite broadly than a mechanism that allows you to sort of move into the judiciary and say this specific party is a threat. I mean, I think all these things come out of a specific historical experience. So, you know, to some extent, you can't really read one country's experience into another. As you say, Germany is a special case, but, you know, every country has a different relationship between the people and the state and the law enforcement arms of the state.
Well, to Japan now, speaking of which, where it says here people are forgetting stuff at a record clip. Japan's National Police Agency has calculated that 29,787,000 items were reported lost across the country last year, which actually doesn't seem that many when you run the numbers. It's like one item for every four Japanese people. And also, imagine living in a country where it is believed actually worth notifying the cops when you lose something. It is arguable that the real story here is that the Japanese are a diligent and organized people who have built a commendably functional society. More on that one shortly. Olga, to establish a benchmark here, I did want to ask you both in turn. I will ask you first, Olga. Are you a regular loser of things?
No, I'm actually not. But, you know, now that I thought about it, I just remember that about 2 weeks ago, I forgot my backpack in a park. And, you know, I was on a bike and I just cycled away. And then I'm like, why am I so light? And like, oh my God.
Actually, surprisingly easily done. I have done that myself, got halfway from a friend's house or a restaurant to the tube and thinking, yeah, I feel strangely unencumbered. And that's because my laptop is still at the restaurant. Jacob, what about you?
Not generally, although I found since I've had children, I have found that my view of what has to be brought with us has expanded considerably. Mm. We can't leave the house without a number of pieces of infrastructure.
What kind of percentage of those pieces make it back from a day out?
I mean, I think I have a commendable record. It's at least 90%. But there was the sad case, the cautionary tale of Twinkle the Koala.
A beloved
stuffed animal left behind at an arcade at a friend's birthday party and then did not turn up at the lost and found. But now we now have a useful cautionary tale that we can turn to and say, remember what happened to Twinkle.
Well, listeners, if any of you have seen Twinkle, do please get in touch and I will pass your details along to Jacob. But that does bring us to the next part of the question, Olga, which is, have you ever reported the loss of anything to some sort of lost and found arrangement and actually got your thing back? My mind is boggling at this story.
Well, I never lost something that valuable for me to report it, but my daughter recently lost a number of hats on the bus in Oxford. A number of hats, yeah. It was more than one hat, and it happened on several occasions. And each time I contacted Lost and Found, and it was never found.
So she's lost an individual hat on several occasions, not a lot of hats at once.
She lost several hats on several occasions.
Okay. I was just wondering what she... I was wondering if wearing many hats was a thing they were doing in Oxford now.
No, I actually thought that maybe we should do that next time, because the consistency of her forgetting her hats on the bus was really striking.
Because, Jacob, the thing that boggles my mind, well, actually a lot boggles my mind about this story, I mean, it says the most common lost items are wireless earphones, mini fans, small electronic ephemera, which is not that surprising, but also near the top of the list, reusable shopping bags. So my question is, Jacob, how do you think the police where you are would react if you called them and said, I've left a tote bag on the tube?
I think unrestrained laughter. Possibly of a mocking variety. If you got a particularly with it policeman, you might just get a raised eyebrow and a... Are you sure this rises to the level of attention of the Metropolitan Police?
It clearly rises to the attention of the level of the attention of the Japanese police, which I cannot help but think is perhaps why their country is better organized, safer, and just in many respects nicer than this one. I mean, in London, I think if you were literally being burgled and murdered at the same time and you called the police, they would say, we might be able to send someone round next Tuesday, but don't hold your breath. I'm going to do that next time I lose something really trivial. I am. I'm going to call my local police and say, I've lost this. Can you
but
help
to,
me?
To be fair to London, Andrea, I have to admit that I found my backpack after 10 minutes being away. It was still there waiting for me on the same bench in the park. Nobody stole it.
Okay. Well, that's heartwarming. I stand mildly corrected. Olga Takariuk and Jacob Parakilis, thank you both for joining us. Finally, on today's show, the job of representing the United Kingdom in Afghanistan has always been one of the more challenging in diplomacy. One early such emissary, Captain Sir Alexander Burns, fell victim to an angry mob in Kabul in 1841 during a previous British military intervention. The last such ambassador, Sir Laurie Bristow, left Kabul in scarcely less perilous circumstances amid the chaotic Western withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, ending a posting he had only accepted a few months previously. Sir Laurie recalls the experience in a new book called Kabul Final Call. I spoke to Sir Laurie at Midori House earlier and began by asking why, given the deteriorating situation in Afghanistan in early 2021, he decided to take the job.
I'm a Russianist by background, and my previous ambassadorial job had been in Moscow. I mean, when the job came up, obviously I looked at it very hard and thought pretty carefully about it. I'd done a lot of work on counterterrorism, work on the national security dossiers previously. And you know, it was very clear that there's one of those really, really big moments coming. So the decision had been taken by the Trump administration to withdraw US-led NATO forces from Afghanistan. But the job was still to do what we were there to do. So the challenge was to keep an embassy open, but in an environment where everything we were doing had been underwritten by the military presence for the previous 20 years, and deliver what we were there to do, which was to suppress the threat to the UK from Al-Qaeda and to work with the government of Afghanistan to achieve that.
But were you optimistic when you embarked that it might still be possible to keep some kind of embassy functioning even after the withdrawal of US and other forces?
I think in these scenarios, you have to be realistic about what's likely to happen. But that was the job. That was the political direction. That's what we were there to do. And I took the job on, I think, like everybody else who was there in the embassy, prepared to give it our best go. But, you know, knowing full well that it probably wouldn't work, that, you know, we would at some stage on my watch have to close that embassy. And even when the time came, you know, my role would be to get our people out of there as safely as possible.
Well, the book is a day-by-day diary-style accounting of the approach to the point of no return. And even though I'm sure most readers will recall the story and the circumstances and certainly will remember the ghastly denouement of the whole thing, it's still a very tense read as you sort of try to absorb in real time what is going on. When you think back on that period, though, was there one particular moment at which there was no getting away from the idea that, okay, this is it, the point of no return has been reached, we are going to have to get out of here?
Yeah, there are several points that I think, you know, you could understand in that way. I mean, one where I think the mood really changed, both in my own mind and more widely and in the government, was the weekend of the 4th of July. Mm. So, you know, US Independence Day, that was the weekend where Bagram Air Base closed. And you'll remember the circumstances of that. Essentially, the Americans upped and left the lights on the vehicles, the ones that were still running, keys in the ignition for some of them. But that was the point at which I think everybody realized this is for real. You know, the military drawdown, the military withdrawal is happening. It has pretty much happened by this stage. And as far as the embassies are concerned, this is crunch point. You know, we no longer have that military underpinning. And as far as the government was concerned, the government of Afghanistan, I think that was also a bit of a turning point where the penny dropped that this was going to happen. It wasn't going to be reversed. And I think that's the point from which you can probably track essentially the progressive collapse in morale of the Afghan armed forces across the country as the Taliban military action doubled down and accelerated.
I mean, it is tempting to wonder, reading the book, how much of it you may have left out, because you do tell a story of an extraordinarily focused mission led by an extraordinarily focused ambassador, i.e. yourself, trying to keep a grip on a deteriorating situation and having to make an extraordinary number of decisions, like actual proper life and death decisions, not just about you and your own staff, but the many, many people you are trying to get out of Afghanistan. Was it always entirely possible to keep a head that cool? Were there not moments of despair, even verging on panic, or does the Foreign Office kind of breed that out of you by the time you've reached ambassador rank?
To be perfectly honest, no, I don't think anything prepares you for this kind of situation experience. I mean, you do the best you can with what you've got. So, I mean, there were a few points where, you know, looking back on it, it was really right at the edge where a few things had gone a slightly different way, we would have been facing absolute disaster. So just to spell out a few of those, you know, there was a period of about 24 hours after Ghani, the president, had left the country after the government, the state had collapsed, where we lost control of the airport. We didn't have enough soldiers by that stage in Kabul to hold the airport. And so you'll remember the scenes of thousands of desperate people wandering backwards and forwards across the runway, some of them clinging on to an aeroplane as it took off and falling off it to their deaths. So there was a period where we couldn't get planes in and we couldn't get people out. And, you know, that was really quite sobering. It was a very, very long night. The other point, I think, where if things had gone just very slightly differently, it would have been dead British soldiers, dead Foreign Office staff. That was the attack on the Abbey Gate, the Islamic State attack on the Abbey Gate. Slightly different timing, different people in different places. It would have been our people rather than the 170 Afghans and the 13 US service people who were killed. I think the other thing just to underline here is, I mean, you can call it what you like. I mean, the fog of war, making sense of things after the event. But one of the reasons for writing the book was that there's just so much where you have, you know, a not complete understanding at the time. And, you know, what you're trying to do after the event is just think through, understand what happened there. Could things have gone differently? Could we have done things differently? And maybe just to zoom out a little bit, I mean, that was one of the reasons for writing the book. I mean, let's come back to what happened here. You know, we were in Afghanistan for 20 years. We lost 457 British soldiers in Afghanistan, countless Afghans, thousands of US soldiers and other allied soldiers. Why did it happen? Why did it end that way? We need to try and understand, to make sense of that, because otherwise we will not learn from it.
That does prompt the obvious question of whether it did have to be like that, whether there was an element of Donald Trump's administration getting played when they signed the agreement with the Taliban in Doha. This was the agreement that President Biden agreed to follow through on, whether, as people I know who were there and who were absolutely furious about how everything ended have suggested, if the US had said, we will keep Bagram and we will keep Kabul Airport, they could have maintain some kind of presence in Afghanistan, couldn't they?
Yeah, well, that's a viewpoint I agree with. You know, it's, I think when it became clear that the government of Afghanistan and its armed forces were losing the battle with the Taliban very, very quickly and very badly, you know, there were points where we could have said, the Americans could have said, actually, we're going to press pause here. But what the Doha Agreement says, you know, the agreement between Donald Trump's administration and the Taliban, is not only that there will be a reduction in violence — that didn't happen, the Taliban escalated the violence — but they would enter into power-sharing negotiations with the government. They didn't do that either. So there was always the option of going back to them and saying, look, pause, you haven't held up your side of the bargain here. For that to be credible, we would have had to have kept a small number of troops in Afghanistan. And it's since come out, it's been various US military figures, including General Milley, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and General McKenzie, the CENTCOM commander, have told Congress that that was their advice to President Trump and to President Biden. The advice wasn't taken. You know, that's the prerogative of the president. But it's also worth, I think, stepping back a little bit and just reminding ourselves of the political context. So what we had here was a war which had, at its height under the Obama surge, 130,000 foreign troops in Afghanistan. That did not deliver a political settlement that would enable our soldiers to leave safely.
That was Sir Laurie Bristow, former UK ambassador to Afghanistan, speaking to me earlier. His book, Kabul, Final Call, The Inside Story of the Withdrawal from Afghanistan, is available now. That's all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Olga Tokariuk and Jacob Parakilis. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by Gunnar Grunlid. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.